Ambition. In college, my friend Beth was very ambitious, not only for herself, but for her friends. She was interested in foreign relations, in travel, in going to law school. "I plan to be Secretary of State someday," she would say matter-of-factly. One mutual friend was studying literature, planning to go to graduate school. He would be the chairman of the Yale English Department. Another friend was interested in political journalism and would someday edit Time magazine. I was a biology major, which was a problem. Beth's best friend from childhood was also studying biology, and Beth had already decided she would win the Nobel Prize. This was resolved by my interest in writing fiction. I would win that Nobel, while her other friend would win for science. It was a joke. We were all smart-ass college freshmen, pretending the world was ours for the asking. But it was not entirely a joke. We were smart college freshmen, and why should we limit our ambitions? I've always liked ambitious people, and many of my closest friends have had grandiose dreams. I like such people, not because I am desperate to be buddies with a future Secretary of State, but because I find ambitious people entertaining, interesting to talk to, fun to watch. And, of course, I like such people because I am ambitious myself, and I would rather not feel apologetic about it. What I mean by ambition is dreaming big dreams, putting no limits on your expectations and your hopes. I don't really like very specific, attainable ambitions, the kind you learn to set in the career strategy course taught by the author of How to Stomp Your Way to Success. I like big ambitions that suggest that the world could open up at any time, with work and luck and determination. The next book could hit it big. The next research project could lead to something fantastic. The next bright idea could change history. Of course, eventually you have to stop being a freshman in college. You limit your ambitions and become more realistic, wiser about your potential, your abilities, the number of things your life can hold. Sometimes you get close to something you wanted to do, only to find it looks better from far away. Back when I was a freshman, to tell the truth, I wanted to be Jane Goodall. Go into the jungle to study monkeys and learn things no one had ever dreamed of. This ambition was based on an interest in biology and several National Geographic television specials. It turned out that wasn't enough of a basis for a life. There were a number of other early ambitions that didn't pan out either. I was not fated to live a wild, adventurous life, to travel alone to all the most exotic parts of the world, to leave behind a string of broken hearts. Oh well, you have to grow up, at least a little. One of the worst things ambition can do is to tell you that you're a failure. The world is full of measuring tapes, books, and articles to tell you where you should be at your age, after so and so many years of doing what you do. I read an article recently about how one's 20s are the decade for deciding on a career and finishing your training, and the 30s are for consolidating your success and rising within your chosen job. And here I am in my 30s, not even sure what I want to do yet. With all these external yardsticks, the last thing anyone needs is an internal voice as well, whispering irritably that you were supposed to do it better, get further, and that all you've actually accomplished is mush since you haven't met your own goals. The world is full of disappointed people. Some of them probably never had much ambition to start with. They sat back and waited for something good and felt cheated because it never happened. Some of them had very set, specific ambitions and, for one reason or another, never got what they wanted. Others got what they wanted, but found it wasn't exactly what they'd expected it to be. Disappointed ambition provides fodder for both drama and melodrama. Aspiring athletes who could have been contenders, aspiring dancers, All they ever needed was the music and the mirror. The world is full of people so ambitious, so consumed by drive and overdrive, that nothing they pass on the way to success has any value at all. Life becomes one long exercise in delayed gratification. Everything you do, you're doing only because it will one day get you where you want to be. Medical training is an excellent example of delayed gratification. You spend years in medical school, doing things with no obvious relationship to your future as a doctor, and then you spend years in residency, living life on a miserable schedule, staying up all night and slogging through the day, telling yourself that one day all this will be over. It's what you have to do to become a doctor, but it's a lousy model for life in general. There's nothing wrong with a little delayed gratification every now and then, but a job you do only because of where it will get you, and not because you like it, means a life of muttering to yourself, "Someday this will be over." This is bad for the disposition. As you grow up, your ambitions may come into conflict. Most prominently nowadays, we have to hear about women torn between family and career, about women who make it to the top only to realize they left their most precious things behind. Part of growing up, of course, is realizing that there is only so much room in one life, whether you are male or female. You can do one thing wholeheartedly and single-mindedly and give up some other things. Or you can be greedy and grab for something new without wanting to give up what you already have. This leads to a chaotic and crowded life in which you are always late, always overdue, always behind, but rarely bored. Even so, you have to come to terms with limitations. You cannot crowd your life with occupations and then expect to do each one as well as you might if it were all you had to do. People consumed by ambition, living with ambition, get to be a little humorless, a little one-sided. On the other hand, people who completely abrogate their ambition aren't all fun and games either. I've met a certain number of women whose ambitions are no longer for themselves at all. Their lives are now dedicated to their offspring. "I hope my children grow up to be nice people, smart people, people who use good grammar. And I hope they grow up to find things they love to do, and do well. But my ambitions are still for me." Of course, I try to be mature about it all. I don't assign my friends Nobel Prizes or top government posts. I don't pretend that there is room in my life for any and every kind of ambition I can imagine. Instead, I say piously that all I want are three things. I want to write as well as I can. I want to have a family. And I want to be a good pediatrician. And then, of course, a voice inside whispers, to write a bestseller, to have 10 children, to do stunning medical research. Fame and fortune, it whispers, fame and fortune. Even though I'm not a college freshman anymore, I'm glad to find that little voice still there, whispering sweet nothings in my ear. New words: abrogate, apologetic, attainable, bestseller, consolidate, contender, grandiose, irritably, matter-of-factly, melodrama, mush, one-sided, overdrive, prominently, residency, slog, smartass, wholeheartedly, yardstick.
Hacker or Mike? There are two kinds of people in the world: those who play sports and those who excel at sports. The men I know who belong to the former group keep trying to join the latter group. We are unable to relinquish the fond hope that one day our aging limbs will miraculously become well-coordinated. Take me, for example. I play basketball. I know I'm not good, but I can't stop. I've been bad for years. In grammar school, I actually went the wrong way on the court and took a shot at the wrong basket. It didn't go in. In high school, I was the sixth man on a five-man team. If any of the starters had been injured, they would probably have forfeited the game rather than put me in. In college, I played regular, unofficial games with an odd assortment of varsity football and lacrosse players, and once broke my right index finger. I think I stepped on it. I'm now nearly 35 years old and play with a group of over 40 lawyers on Thursday nights. Basketball is the ultimate hacker sport. I can rebound, I can score occasionally, but I'm basically a body in the free throw lane, the preferred hacker position. It is possible to have a career in the hacking game. The injuries you get are minor: broken noses, turned ankles, jammed fingers. Real athletes, and some of them do condescend to join us from time to time, always seem to have serious injuries. The two real athletes who play with us have injuries that are whispered about. Something is wrong with their Achilles tendon, or their eye sockets, or their calf muscles, something serious. We're not quite sure what. A hacker can get away with the most outrageous, stupid plays, merely because he's doing what everybody expects of him. I seem to have a tendency for behind-the-back buffoonery. I once tried a behind-the-back pass that, surprise, ended up in the hands of a person on the sidelines. Another time, I received the ball down the court, jumped up uselessly, and executed a nifty behind-the-back pass to no one. Until recently, I was reconciled, more or less, to being mediocre for life. Then my wife, Christine, put the two of us on a fast walking routine, and I started playing tennis every day. Suddenly, my hand-eye coordination got better, and my legs got stronger. "I bet this will help your basketball game," said Christine. She was right. I began to show signs of real talent. I acquired a feel for the game I never had before. I made the right moves without thinking about them. I developed a shooter's touch. In one game, I took three consecutive shots from beyond the three-point line and made all three perfectly. Even before the last one went in, I turned and started running nonchalantly back up the court. Hey, be like Mike. I'll never forget my best game. That feeling that nothing could go wrong for me started almost immediately. I had the ball to the right of the free throw lane with my back to the basket. Long Arms was guarding me. I tried a hook shot. I threw the ball against the backboard rather than arching it, but it went in. Everyone laughed, including me. I went back on defense, and Long Arms tried to go around me to shoot. I blocked his shot. He tried another one. I blocked it, too. "I didn't think you'd get it," he said. On offense again, I found myself ahead of the rest, dribbling the ball. I hesitated. When you're over 6 feet tall in the hack game, you're not expected to score very much, and no one expects you to shoot much. I dutifully passed the ball off, maneuvered into the free throw lane, and scored up a pass back to me. But the next time down, I felt confident. I shot without hesitation, and the ball swished in. Someone shouted, "Trash!" It was the ultimate compliment. Or at least I thought so, until the end of the game, when corner shooter asked me if I'd been to basketball school recently. The next game started out the same way. I caught a rebound and made a basket. Then a pass came to the man I was guarding to the right of the free throw lane. I dove for it, but I didn't get it. Something gave in my left calf. I went down, and when I got up, I couldn't walk. Someone took my place. Corner shooter brought me some ice. I had never had anyone bring me ice before. "You probably tore it," said athlete one. I was thrilled. At last, a serious injury. I was out for 2 weeks, and during that time, all I could do was worry about whether I was still good. For my return, I sported an elastic bandage wrapped conspicuously around my calf. Corner Shooter was impressed. "Nice," he said. Back in my customary place near the basket, I felt good. Nothing had changed. The basket was mine. Less mobile, new guy, edged into my territory. I was going to score, but I dropped the ball. A moment later, at the other side of the court, I brushed by my teammate, freeing myself from my opponents. I decided it was time to make my move. I loped down the court like a gazelle and took a shot. Air ball! I didn't even come near the basket. That was a pass, I joked. Humbled, I fought for a rebound under the basket and went up for an easy shot. No problem. Clank! It banged off the rim, missing again. So I look bad again. Actually, I'm kind of relieved. I'm a hacker. Who can argue with destiny? Besides, I discovered early on in my temporary transformation that excellence isn't all that I thought it would be. It's too much pressure. Be like Mike? No thanks. I'd rather be like me. New words. Arch. Assortment. Backboard. Bandage. Buffoonery. Clank. Condescend. Consecutive. Conspicuously. Dutifully. Elastic. Excellence. Forfeit. Gazelle. Index. Lacrosse. Limb. Lope. Nifty. Nonchalantly. Outrageous. Reconcile. Relinquish. Rim. Shooter. Sideline. Swish. Tendon. Unofficial. Romantic ambition. All persons possess some level of ambition. It is not surprising, therefore, that all persons determine the goals to which their ambitions are directed. For some it may be wealth, for others power. And for many, there is a strong desire to live a life with rich romantic influences. Romance, in its broader meaning, refers to a zest for life, an energetic pursuit in any and all relationships, with others as well as with nature, and indeed in all human and natural activity. If one lacks a romantic zest and energy for daily pursuits, other goals may seem empty and pointless. Consider the fact that many persons openly admit that, while they would prefer to live comfortably, they do not wish to be wealthy in an economic sense. Perhaps they take their position from the biblical statement that it is harder for a rich man to enter heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. But more often, the reason is more directly related to the same reason many persons do not aspire to great power during their lives. The reasons these goals are not greatly sought or valued, even by otherwise ambitious, talented persons, are not entirely clear. But it is absolutely certain that for many persons, these goals do not have high priority in their choices. In fact, both excessive wealth and great power have often been misused and do not of themselves lead to better personal relationships. There clearly are goals which do not lead to greater romance in living, do not add zest to life, and do not support enthusiastic and energetic participation in relationships. How then does one recognize a romantic individual? First of all, romance is not just love between two people. You can't really have romance with someone else or with nature unless you are romantic yourself. Romance is something you have to take care of and to nurture. Romance needs food and water and care of a kind all her own. you can destroy romance, or at least drive her away, almost without knowing that you are doing it. The best way to recognize a romantic person is to be around romantics. There is a sense of passion about them, a sense of being a bit too far out on the edge emotionally. Sometimes, it's a caring for what seems to be unimportant things or persons, an old chair, a favorite knife, a favorite family member, or a piece of art or music. Romantics tend to like animals. Those animals which sense the zest in the romantic and decide to stay around and join in this place of food and laughter. You don't have to be a poet or a painter or a musician to be a romantic. Industrialists, religious people, teachers, students, or any other persons who have a zest for their chosen field can be romantics. Romance is practical. It provides energy for living and furnishes a sense of vision, hope, and caring. Because you are working for others, not just yourself, your work takes on a certain quality that it otherwise lacks. People who need people are the luckiest people in the world. Is not just a pretty song, it is at the heart of romance. Romance is hard to gain, hard to keep, and fairly easy to drive away. If you are really intent on getting rid of romance, here are a few ways to do it. Become obsessive in your neatness, particularly in the way your desk looks. Install expensive carpets in your house, so you will be upset when your friend or your dog makes a mess on it. Don't listen to good music. Focus excessively on detail at the expense of vision, of dreams, of reflection. And finally, the surest way to lose romance is to do things just for money, even though your best conscience tells you this is not what you should be doing. On the other hand, there are some goals which will put more romance into your life. If one would keep romance, these are some things that can help. Read some poetry every day. Try some of the old classics, such as Shakespeare, Keats, or Kipling, as well as some of the good modern poetry. Even better, write your own poetry. Set up a schedule for yourself when you can read. Get up early in the morning, in the solitude, that is only possible when other persons do not interfere with your focus on reading. Sometime, build your own house, or at least some intimate parts of it. Design it or decorate it to your own taste and with lots of thought, and you'll find pleasure in living in a place that is a product of your own effort and ambition. Collect little things, a small box, a favorite piece of jewelry, a coin. Play a musical instrument, no matter how simple or complex, or just learn to whistle or hum a tune to yourself. Travel when possible, because novelty and new associations are important in romance. And most of all, many romantics keep some type of journal, diary, or notes in a pocket calendar. Later, these will remind you of the enjoyable time and the relationships you have formed. Romance is not just outward bound and found away from one's familiar surroundings. It also rides on one's shoulders when one returns home. Perspectives can be gained not only from reviewing one's journal notes, but by noticing the more familiar things and persons at home. Romance is all around. It's not somewhere else. Romance occurs in the most common environment. Anyone can see the beauty of the mountains, but it takes a little more perspective to see the beauty of a rural landscape, a desert, or the long sweep of a grassland or river. Not only obvious and famous places are settings for romance, the humble, well-used, and little things in life are common factors in romance. Finally, how will you know that you have lived a romantic life? On one's deathbed, when all the living and doing is finished, one might well think of R.M. Rilke's poetic musing. I live my life in growing orbits, which move out over the things of this world. Perhaps I can never achieve the last, but that will be my attempt. I am circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I am circling for 1,000 years. And I still do not know if I'm a falcon, or a storm, or a great song. When one has done this, if one can smile and nod quietly to oneself, one has been a romantic, and romance will ride on one's shoulder while returning home and for eternity. New words. Biblical. Eternity. Falcon. Furnish. Hum. Industrialist. Intent. Interfere. Landscape. Mess. Muse. Romantic. Surroundings. The virtues of ambition. The word ambition means different things to different people, and the way you define it reveals a great deal about yourself. The 7th edition of Webster's Dictionary, supposedly neutral in its approach, defines ambition first and foremost as an ardent desire for rank, fame, or power. Isn't that too narrow? Surely, ambition is not only behind dreams of wealth, of glory, of distinction, and of accomplishment, but also behind dreams of love, of pleasure, and of goodness. Thus, historically, it is neither a completely positive nor a negative term. We all have dreams, but what life does with our dreams and our expectations cannot, of course, be predicted. Some dreams, begun in selflessness, end in hatred. Other dreams, begun in selfishness, end in large-heartedness. However, the unpredictability of the outcome of dreams is no reason to stop dreaming. To be sure, ambition is never a pretty subject to think about for long. Just as drunks have done to alcohol, the single-mindedly ambitious people have done to ambition, given it a bad name. Like those individuals with a strong desire for alcohol, some people have an equally strong desire for ambition, which cannot be satisfied. Some people cannot handle ambition and cause grief for themselves and for others as well. Still, none of this seems sufficient to make people be secretive about being ambitious. It is easy for us to believe that those who have achieved the common goals of ambition, money, fame, and power, have achieved them through corruption of a greater or lesser degree, mostly greater. Thus, all politicians in high places, thought to be ambitious, are understood to be without ethical principles. We wonder how they could have ethical principles and still have risen as high as they have. Certainly, people do not seem less interested in success and what it can do for us now than formerly. Summer homes, European vacations, travel, BMWs, such items do not seem less in demand than they did a decade or 2 years ago. What has happened is that people cannot admit their dreams as easily and openly as they once could, lest they be thought of as pushing, acquisitive, and vulgar. For such people, and many more perhaps not so outstanding, the proper action seems to be succeed at all costs, but refrain from appearing ambitious. The attacks on ambition are many and come from various angles, while its public defenders are few and ineffective. As a result, the support for ambition as a healthy impulse, a quality to be admired and cultivated in the young, is probably lower than it has ever been in the United States. This does not mean that ambition is at an end, that people no longer feel its urges, but only that since it is no longer openly honored, it is therefore less often openly professed. Consequences follow from this, of course, some of which are that ambition is driven underground or made devious. Many people are naturally distrustful of ambition, feeling that it represents something uncontrollable in human nature. Thus, John Dean entitled his book about his involvement in the Watergate affair during the Nixon administration, Blind Ambition, as if ambition were to blame for his ignoble actions, and not the many qualities that make up his rather shabby character. But considering things the other way, it is also bad to have no ambition just because of the fear of having too many. To discourage ambition is to discourage dreams of grandeur and greatness. All men and women are born, live, suffer, and die. What distinguishes us from one another is our dreams. Whether they be dreams about worldly or unworldly things, and what we do to make them come about. It may seem an exaggeration to say that ambition is the connection to all of society, which holds all of its elements together, but it is not much of an exaggeration. Remove ambition, and the essential elements of society seem to fly apart. Ambition, as opposed to mere fantasizing about desires, implies work and discipline to achieve goals, personal and social, of a kind society cannot survive without. Ambition is intimately connected with family. For men and women not only work partly for their families, husbands and wives are often ambitious for each other, but harbor their most important ambitions for their children. It is not difficult to imagine a world without ambition. It would probably be a kinder world, without demands, without damage, without disappointments. People would have time for reflection. Such work as they did would not be for themselves, but for the collectivity. Competition would never enter in. Conflict would be eliminated, and tension would become a thing of the past. The stress of creation would be at an end. Art would no longer be troubling, but merely used to celebrate life. Longevity would be increased, for fewer people would die of heart attack or stroke caused by conflicts at work. Anxiety would be extinct. Time would stretch on and on, with ambition long departed from the human heart. Ah, how unbelievably boring life would be. There is a strong view that success is a myth, and ambition, therefore, a sham. Does this mean that success does not really exist? That achievement is empty? That the efforts of men and women are of no significance alongside the force of movements and events? Now, not all success, obviously, is of value, nor all ambition worth cultivating. Which are and which are not is something one soon enough learns on one's own. But even the most cynical people admit that success exists, that achievement counts for a great deal. To believe otherwise could cause one to become irrational. If one believes that ambitions are useless, this by implication removes all motive for competence, interest in attainment, and regard for the future. We do not choose to be born. We do not choose our parents. We do not choose our historical epoch, the country of our birth, or the way in which we are brought up. We do not, most of us, choose to die, nor do we choose the time or conditions of our death. But within all this realm of lack of choice, we must choose how we shall live, courageously or in cowardice, honorably or dishonorably, with purpose or in drift. We must decide what is important and what is trivial in life. We must also decide that what makes us significant is either what we do or what we refuse to do. But no matter how indifferent the universe may be to our choices and decisions, these choices and decisions are ours to make. We decide, we choose, and as we decide and choose, so are our lives formed. In the end, forming our own destiny is what ambition is about. New words: acquisitive, attainment, collectivity, courageously, devious, dishonorably, distrustful, exaggeration, extinct, fantasize, foremost, grandeur, honorably, ignoble, large-heartedness, lest, neutral, profess, realm, secretive, selfishness, sham, significance, uncontrollable, underground, unworldly.